Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and welcome to the Juror 13 show on Blog Talk Radio. My name is Denny Griffin, and for the next hour, I will be co-hosting the show, and it's going to be a continuation of our series of programs talking about domestic violence. And co-hosting with me tonight is the co-founder of Peace for the Missing, Delilah Jones. Delilah, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me, Denny.
Well, I'm very honored that, that you were able to make it and give me a hand tonight. And joining us tonight as our guest is Abigail Luray. Abigail is a published author. She became a published author in May of 2008. She has two books. The first, Graceful Reflections, and it's about domestic violence. And she added a novel, The Birthplace of Evil. And she also has a children's book, which she has submitted with her own illustrations to a children's book publisher. Abby, welcome to the show.
Good evening, Denny, and thank you for having me.
Well, it's our pleasure. What I'd like to do, Abby, if you could you give the listeners a little background on Graceful Reflections, why you wrote it, the story behind it, and so forth, so everybody will get a feel for it.
Okay. When I wrote Graceful Reflections, I wrote it based on things that had happened in my life. And I had a lot of pain, a lot of emotional things that I had to work through. And while I was writing the book, I was pretty much just transcribing some of the events that had happened in my life and all the pain and the suffering that I was going through. And when I was going through the domestic abuse, it was during the years that there weren't any laws on the books for helping women or anything. So just trying to go through it and survive it, that was pretty hard, not only with the abuser, but in the course of everything, social system or social services got involved, and the courts and everything, and I ended up losing my children because of everything. But anyway, when I wrote the book, it was just getting everything out of me and being able to make myself a little bit stronger. And during the course of writing it, I learned one great big huge lesson, and the good Lord was just trying to teach me to learn how to forgive my abuser and also to forgive myself. So that's pretty much what the book is about. It just delves into a lot of the experiences I went through with my ex-husband and also with the court system.
Abby, I don't know if you have caught some of the previous shows. In fact, we've had just recently talking about the courts and the way some victims of domestic violence end up losing their children. And in some cases, the children are placed in the custody of the abuser. Did you happen to catch that program?
I'm not sure if I caught that one or not. I've been listening as often as I can. I've just had so much coming up.
I understand.
That it takes me away.
Well, I was very surprised about it. I didn't realize, and I found it scary, upsetting, to find the courts are awarding custody of children in these domestic violence cases, sometimes to the abuser, sometimes when the abuser is still incarcerated. I mean, it's and ordering visitation and supervised visitation, all kinds of bizarre things. And I wasn't aware personally that there was that degree of it going on.
No, I think, Denny, excuse me, I think a lot of times if you haven't been involved in a domestic violence relationship, which you know, just to get it out there, I have not. This I'm learning from people like Abby and Susan and so many others out there that are so willing to teach everything there is to know and things I
That's
don't really
true.
Even want to know. But I think, you know, the general public that hasn't been involved in something like that has no idea. I had no idea.
No, they don't have any idea. And it's scary, too, because you think that the court system and the social services are there to be on the side
right.
to help the parent and everything. And all they're doing is they're taking your children, they're selling your children, and it's a scary thing. It really is. And when all this was going on with me, they ended up putting my ex-husband in prison because the child abuse laws had been passed, but there wasn't anything for domestic abuse. And he was put in prison, so they put my children in foster homes, and I was under the impression that they were doing this to help me so I could get on my feet and get everything together for my children to be able to have them back. And every time I turned around, I was going to court, and they kept coming up with some stupid, ridiculous reason why I couldn't have my children back. And I kept trying and trying, and then I found out they were starting to falsify documents and putting false documents in front of the judge. And the judge would just tell me to hush up. You know, he didn't want to hear anything.
Back when you were going through this, Abby, were there advocates that went to court with you or anyone that advised you on what to do or how to do it?
No.
Did you have an attorney?
The judge did do a court-appointed attorney for me.
Uh-huh.
And my attorney kept getting so frustrated because every time we would go into court, there would be a different caseworker. And, of course, this new caseworker wasn't familiar with everything that was going on. And then my attorney made an argument about it and how I hadn't been notified that there would be a change in caseworkers and everything. So the judge ordered it that anytime there was going to be a change of a caseworker or if the social service department need to get a hold of me, they would go through my attorney, and anytime I wanted to get a hold of social services, I would go through my attorney, and everything was all agreed upon. Well, they never stood up to it. And like I said, every time we went into court, we'd have a different caseworker. And my attorney ended up drawing up some paperwork that showed that there was like, 34 or 37 of my individual rights that had been violated. And he presented it to the judge. The judge threw it out. He says, we're not in a jury trial. So, I mean, every single excuse.
Did this all happen in the same jurisdiction, or were you going to court in different jurisdictions, or was it all in one place?
No, this was all in one place. So I was fighting through the court system for a good two and a half, close to 3 years. And finally, after my ex-husband got out of prison, the last time I went to court, and there is one other thing I do want to elaborate on. Social services had told me all sorts of things that I needed to do in order to be able to get the kids back. And for a while, they were telling me I had to divorce my ex. Well, my ex found out about it, and he started raising a stink about it. So social services ended up telling me, well, you're going to have to stay married to him if you want to get your children back.
So they're kind of giving you mixed signals.
Oh, yeah.
A lot of mixed signals.
And then they were telling me I had to hold down a job, I had to have $200 in the bank, I had to go to parenting classes, I had to go to a psychologist.
Did all of these things?
Yeah. My cupboards had to be completely full of food. My refrigerator had to be completely full of food. I mean, I did everything. And my attorney even presented to the judge that I had done everything and everything that social services wanted me to do. And there was documentation that I had gone through the whole thing, did the whole program, and that there was one time I didn't have quite complete full cupboards because my money was going out for everything else. And they tried holding that against me in court. And the judge, he just kept coming up with stupid excuses. That one was, well, if you can't keep your cupboards full, you're not going to be able to feed your children. So that was one of the reasons.
So they had people come in to your home and check your cupboards?
Yeah, yeah.
Really?
They would do inspections. They would inspect the home to make sure there was enough room for the children. I mean, I didn't mind. I didn't mind them coming in and doing this. But they ended up making up stories. They ended up telling the judge at one point where I was working at. I worked close to where a beach was. And I didn't want to go home to an empty house after work. And I would go down to the beach, and I would just sit down there until it got to be dark. And then I would finally go home. And they ended up telling the judge that I was a beach bum, that I was living on the beach. And they had been to my home like a week before. Yeah, give me a break. But anyway, it was just things like this, back and forth in the courthouse. And
so what ultimately happened with the children? I take it they were in foster care at this time.
They were in foster care, and then after my ex-husband got out of prison, just before he got out, the judge had told me I couldn't have my children back for a lack of communication. That was the very last straw. And he told me, he says, I'm sick and tired of seeing you in and out of my courtroom. I don't want to ever see you here again. And then when my ex got out of prison, he told my ex, he said, now it's your turn to step up to the plate to get the children back. My ex-husband refused. So I don't know how long it was that the children were placed for adoption, but I do know I was fighting with the system about they wanted me to sign off my parental rights, and I never did.
You never did?
I never did. I never signed any paperwork.
How could they put them up for adoption then?
That's a good question. Mm-hmm. If I could figure that one out, trust me, it would help me with the puzzle a little bit more, but I'm still putting together pieces.
Sure.
And this is like, well, it was 24 years ago when they took my children away.
And you haven't seen them since.
And I haven't seen them since, no. And when they took my kids, I had gone to work. I had just started working. I'd been working like about a week, I think it was. And my ex-husband had lost his job, and I was afraid to trust him with the kids. And my youngest, she was like 3 months old, I do believe, at that time. Well, I ended up getting a babysitter, and as soon as I got off work that day, I went to the babysitter's house to get my children, and I was handed a letter. And it was from the Social Services Department stating that they had my children, and if I wanted my children back, I had to go and see them right away. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, just them taking the kids, no forewarning, no nothing, and then all this happening.
You wouldn't think that something like that could happen in America, but it is. It's happening, you know, as we speak, it's happening right now.
It happens everywhere.
Yeah, it does. Stepping back a little bit, you know, and if I touch on things that you know are too touchy for you, just tell me, move on. Okay.
I sure will.
Going back to the abuse, and just, you know, for the sake of the listeners out there, what was your rock bottom? You endured many, many years, and there's so many people that ask the question, well, why didn't you just leave? Why didn't you just leave?
Oh, that is such a good question. But, you know, I ask myself that question a lot, but when I was writing my book, it all fell together because my ex was very controlling.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't allowed to have friends. He would only give me like $30 a week for groceries. He would check the odometer on the car to see.
Did this start from the very beginning of your relationship, or did this
No.
kind of gradually come about?
No. From the very beginning of our relationship, we lived together for, a year or 2 years, and he was a great guy. I mean, mm-hmm. I thought that he would be a perfect choice to get married to, and when he asked me to marry him, I was just tickled pink, and I said yes, and then our wedding day. That was the day that he told me, he said, well, you said I do, and you damn well better do. And I got my first beating my wedding night.
But there were no signals or anything like that before?
No.
That you might have recognized?
No, there weren't. And that,
so he was just pretty much Prince Charming the whole time you were together until the day you got married.
Yep, exactly. And then after the first beating, I mean, it took me by surprise, and he had broken my nose. And after that, you know, I was beginning to be scared of him, but I didn't have anywhere to turn because, come to think about it, during the time that he and I were just living together, I didn't have any friends. Any friends that were there, they were his friends. They weren't my friends.
Basically, your whole being and your whole life revolved around what he liked, what he wanted to do, his feelings. And at that time, you were feeling so in love that it was kind of like it was okay because you enjoyed it. You enjoyed doing things for him and making him happy. Right?
I did. And then after the first beating, that scared me. It took me by surprise. And I'm the type of person that if I did something wrong, I want to try to make it right.
Mm-hmm.
And I kept trying to do better. I couldn't understand what it was that I wasn't doing that he didn't approve of. And
well, yeah, because all this time you were making him happy.
Yeah.
And he was happy with you making him happy.
Well, it seems like it.
Do you have any idea, or do you have any theory as to why? Did he just snap?
Well, the only thing he would ever tell me, and this is after the first few times of him beating me, he was an ex-Marine Corps drill sergeant. And he had been to Vietnam, and he had served a couple of tours of duty over there. And after he had beaten on me, he would tell me, he'd just be so apologetic, and, oh, baby, I'm so sorry. It's just a Vietnam flashback. And I'm trying to work through these. Just bear with me and help me get through this. And I'm sorry, I'll never do it again. And in hindsight, I have to wonder how many times he told me that
mm-hmm.
and how long it really took for it all to sink in. But I was with him for a total of 10 years and putting up with beatings, nowhere to go, and I don't know. Finally, I just ended up getting the courage one day because it finally hit me. He had been threatening me, if you ever leave me, I'm going to kill you. And there were even times that he would threaten to kill me while I was still there with him. And he'd say, you know, I can get rid of your body and no one would know. And I had tried to leave him a couple of times prior, just towards the end of it all. And he found me and he told me, he says, you know, nobody's going to care where you're at. Nobody's going to be looking for you because you decide to up and leave. He says, I could kill you, and nobody just would be able to find you. And it just hit me, and it was like, okay, he's going to kill me if I stay.
Mm-hmm.
He's going to kill me if I leave. I need a fighting chance here. and I'm just going to give it my best shot. And I up and left him.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, he found me after that. he had me arrested, of all things, for stealing my own furniture. But he had me arrested for that. And he ended up kidnapping our last daughter that we had. He ended up kidnapping her from me during the time that I had been real sick. And I had been back and forth to the courthouse with all this because I had gone to another state after I had left him. And my ex had told me before I had left him, he said, if you ever leave me, I've got a dirty attorney who loves to play dirty pool. And sure enough, after I left him, that's when all these charges came up of me stealing my own furniture, but he stated it was his, and everything was transferred down to another state. Well, the state that I was in at that time, I was going back and forth in the court for extradition hearings and stuff, and they weren't going to extradite and all that for a while anyway. And then at that time, I had my oldest son and I had my baby girl with me when I had left my ex-husband. And needless to say, after I got arrested, they were put in to like the foster care in that state. But I was able to get the kids back, and then
this was a previous time.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And then after I got the children back, it was 3 days later that he ended up kidnapping my daughter, and he was I was real sick with pneumonia and everything at that time. And I mean, it was just a total mess.
Mm-hmm.
But it really appalled me with the way the courts and everybody was right behind him. But then to get all this mess cleared up about my furniture, I ended up going to the state where the charges were against me at. I turned myself into the jail, and I had to stay in that state until they had the final court hearing on it. And when I went into court, the judge had called everybody else's name but mine, and then he said, if there's anybody who's here and they have their summons, will you please step forward? And I did, and he asked me what my name was, and I told him, and he said, do you have your summons with you? And I said, yes, Your Honor, I do, and I handed it to him. He looked at it, and he looked real puzzled, and he started conferring with the prosecuting attorney and everything. And then he ended up looking at me, and he says, young lady, he said, there's nothing here on or against you. He said, you're free to go. And I was stunned.
I bet.
I looked at the judge, and I said, you mean to tell me that I'm free to go? There's nothing here on or against me at all. And he said, nope. He said, there isn't. He says, I don't even understand why you were brought in front of me to begin with.
Wow.
So
all of this cyclone that you're in with losing the children and being dragged into court do you think it was kind of not a plot, but something in his mind to make you look like the crazy one?
Exactly. Exactly.
And that happens pretty often.
Yeah.
Abusers,
and
right?
One thing with abusers, they're very devious.
Mm-hmm.
And they're very vicious with their thinking and their manipulation. And I still don't know to this day who his dirty attorney that loves to play dirty pool was. And I still haven't gotten it all figured out how they got that kind of a charge against me when we were married. And it was my furniture. I'm the person who had paid for it. And all the receipts
right.
were in my name. But he still had all this stuff put against me in a different state. And the devious part about it was he just wanted to make sure that he took my baby girl away from me.
So
now my oldest son
looking for the thing that was going to hurt you most.
Yeah, and he knew that my children were the one thing that would pretty much kill me, you know, mm-hmm. if I lost. But I think I really surprised him by hanging on and surviving. And it took me a long time. I mean, I was really torn down really, really bad. But somehow I just started finding strength inside myself, and it started growing more and more. And here I am 24 years later trying to help people regain their strength and become a good survivor. So it's been a long, hard road.
It sounds like it. So what would you say, being in the situation that you've been in, all of, you know, going through all of this 24 years ago and so forth, have you had the opportunity to be with other victims, to be with people that are going through that, and have you been able to advise them some way?
Not so much recently. A few years ago, yeah, there were a couple of people that I spoke with, mm-hmm. and they were talking about how their children had been taken away, and oh, I saw the same kind of tears and everything else that I knew all too well. But my one piece of advice to them was don't trust the system, and, you know.
What would you do differently? If you could go back, if there was anything that you could do differently, as far as going through the system, what do you think should be done, or what should be put in place or taken out of place that would make it a fair playing field?
That is such a good question, Delilah. I really don't know. We've got to get this legal kidnapping aspect out, and that's where the system is making money on any child that they can take away from the parents.
Can you tell the listeners, how do they make money from taking your children away from you?
That I'm still learning about, but I've been doing a lot of reading, and I've also been listening to Senator Nancy Schaefer. Mm-hmm. And somehow the government, way back in 74, I think it was, the beginning point, the president at that time was basically giving the welfare department a bonus for each child that they had in their care, and it was a monetary bonus.
Who did they give the bonus to?
To the social services.
Uh-huh.
I'm not real sure. I'm like I said, I'm still learning about it too. But the social services, any caseworker that takes a child away from a parent, they get a bonus. The foster parents also get a bonus, and any families that adopt children, they're getting a monetary bonus, and they're getting it clear until the child turns 18. And, it's basically what they call legal kidnapping ring right now. And like I said, I'm still learning. But the thing that surprised me the most was 24 years ago they were doing this, because one caseworker that I had, and I had him for a short time, and I wish to God he would have stayed my caseworker throughout, because I know I would have gotten my children back. But he had told me, he said, I want you to be aware, he said, there is money that is exchanging hands within the department. And he said some of it's in the tune of $5,000 or $10,000 per child. And I was completely floored by this, and I thought, well, you know, this is something really odd, you know, it shouldn't concern my kids or anything. And he told me, he said, you know, it's like a snowball that's rolling downhill, and he says, you can't stop it. It gets bigger and bigger. Well, one of the foster parents, when I had visitation with my children, the foster parent told me the exact same thing. And that really surprised me. And I think the one thing I probably would have done differently, this very same caseworker, he had told me, he says, I'm going to give you an extra hour's visitation. He said, you get your children and you leave the state with them. And I wish to God I had of.
Mm-hmm.
But back then, I was afraid to do it because I knew that I could get arrested for kidnapping my own
right.
children, and then I would lose every single chance of ever trying to get them back.
Right.
So I just figured, you know, I'm going
to
go.
So you went along and you followed the rules and you did
yeah.
what you were told to do and what you were advised to do.
Exactly.
And so if you had taken off with your children, what do you think would have happened? I think, you know, we see this happening a lot, okay, one parent or
yeah.
the other, because of whatever reason. Usually it's abuse, but not always.
Not always, no.
But they take off, they hide, they stay hidden for as long as they can. And then there's warrants for kidnapping. There's missing person reports. So you've got all kinds of people looking for you on your tail. You know you're going to be arrested. So you have all that fear to deal with.
Exactly. Exactly. And you know in your heart that they're going to arrest you. If they end up arresting you for your own furniture, you know they're going to end up arresting you for kidnapping your own children.
Sure.
And I don't know. I was raised with my grandmother. She always told me to respect the law. She always told me to abide by the law and be an upstanding citizen. So with having that instilled in me, and then, like you said, doing their rules
yeah.
and doing everything that I was told to do, you know, I figured the system was there to help me get on my feet. They were there to, you know, just help me be able to pull together.
Right, and just like I said earlier, I think that's what most of the general public out there thinks. It's like, okay, you know, I'm the one that's doing things right. So if I go to get a divorce or I go to court for, you know, whatever charges, that I'm doing right, so I should be the one rewarded, right?
Right.
It should come out in my favor. And I think, you know, we all go in with blinders on because I'm finding out, and like I say, I'm learning this along with you. I'm finding out that is not the way it's done.
No, it's not. It's not, and it's getting worse from what I understand as opposed to what it was 24 years ago, but it's almost
mm-hmm.
like 24 years ago laid the foundation for the way it is now.
Mm-hmm.
But there was one other thing that I made a really good discovery about, too, along the way. My oldest son was like he might have been about 11 years old. And after a year, they finally let me have my oldest son back.
Mm-hmm.
So I figured since I got my oldest son, you know, I could prove to them that I'm a good parent and everything else and that I can take care of my child. Well, the day that my oldest son came back to me, he had bruises all over his bottom, and he had it right on the very bottom part of his back. And
this is from the foster home?
And this
foster
is from
home?
The foster home, exactly. And the bruises that he had on him were like 2 or 3 days old, I think it was. And I didn't know what to do about it. But then I got to thinking, well, maybe I should talk to my attorney. So I called my attorney. He said, bring him here and let me see. So I took my oldest son to my attorney, and my attorney saw it. He said, well, you need to go to social services, let them take pictures of this, and let them document it and everything. And I looked at my attorney. I was about ready to cry, and I told him, I said, they're going to say that I did it. And he said, I can tell that these are not fresh bruises. He
mm-hmm.
said, they are 2 or 3 days old. And he said, you know, you've got me. I'm a witness as to what we see here, you know.
Right.
So he said, you go and do this. So I went to the welfare department. Of course, they started screaming that I was the person who had bruised my son and everything. And I said, give me a break. His first day home, and I have been fighting all this time to get him and to get the others. Do you think I'm going to hurt my child? And they just kept yelling about it. And I told him, I said, well, you call my attorney. My attorney has seen it. So the caseworker, she ended up speaking with my attorney, and he forewarned her. He told her, he said, you know, if you try to press any kind of charges against my client here, he said, we'll get you for false charges or something like that, falsifying a report or something or other. I forget exactly what it was now. And he said, you know, I can tell that those bruises are not fresh. So anyway, the caseworker wanted me to take my son to the welfare department's doctor. When I talked to my attorney, he says, no, you take him to your doctor. And I did. And, of course, the welfare department was all put out, and they told the judge that I wouldn't cooperate with them and do everything that they wanted me to do. And I mean, it was just
a
big old mess.
What did they want you to do? My gosh.
I bent over backwards
trying
to do everything.
You jumped through every hoop there was to jump through, and still, you know.
Still they wanted more.
Right, they wanted more.
Yeah,
it's just amazing to me.
Ladies, can I interrupt for just a second?
You sure can.
Sure.
I realized I forgot to give out our phone number at the start of the show, so if anybody's listening and would like to call in with a question or comment, you can reach us at 646-478-0982. 646-478-0982. And Abby, one other thing. Do you have a website or where people could go to if they needed to contact you or wanted to ask you questions or to buy your books?
Yeah. Actually, I've got a couple of websites here.
Okay, why don't you give them out first?
Okay, the first one is www.abigailluray.blogspot.com, and I've just started up another blog, which this one is a Survivor's Fight for Change, and I'm just kind of getting into the nitty-gritty of researching all this legal kidnapping and everything. But anyway, the blogspot Addy for this one is www.survivorsholdingtight.blogspot.com.
Okay, and one last question.
Sure.
There's been talk on previous Juror 13 shows, the domestic violence shows, about establishing a central site where people could go to get information, to get links to other resources and so forth. What are your thoughts on that as a victim? Do you think that would be beneficial? And if you run across such a site yourself, I've heard different things that there are some sites out there, but they're not necessarily connected or linked.
Yeah.
And there's not one central repository for information. Well, what's been your experience and what are your thoughts on having a central location or site where people can go to?
I think a central location would be ideal. I really do. And it would be really beneficial, especially if you have one for, like, the child abuse things that I've seen here on the Internet. And because I've noticed there's different areas of the abuses that people are really blogging about or commenting about on Facebook and advocating on Facebook. And, I mean, you've got, like, the child abusers. You've got the survivors. You've got the legal kidnapping thing. You've got the safety, like with Susan Murphy Milano and Annie Jacoby. But I think if we could get everything all into one central location, I think that would be ideal. I really do. Because there's so many links out there, and it's hard to keep up with everybody's.
Absolutely. Well, thanks, Abby. And Delilah, I'll toss
it
back to you.
If what? I'm sorry?
I'm tossing it back to you.
Oh, I see. Thanks.
Catch me, Delilah.
Catch you. Okay. No, I have to agree. I think a central location for information and everything is really the way to go, because you think about how many women or men out there that are going through the same situations that Abby and so many others are going through.
Oh,
and
yeah.
If there was just one click that they could get the information that they need, reliable information, you know.
That is true.
There's a lot of information out there. But sometimes you have to do your own research to find out where the information came from, and, you know, is this really the truth, and so on and so forth.
Exactly.
So I think it would be a fabulous idea.
I do too, and I don't know how we would go about being able to do this. Do you?
I think Chloe has some ideas.
Cool.
Yeah, I think so. I think they had spoken about that at, you know, a previous show, and I think
it's probably one of the ones I missed.
Could be, but yeah, I totally agree with the whole concept. I think it's something that's very necessary, you know, because I, you know, in a situation like you were in, people just really don't know where to turn.
No, they
don't. Do you find that with other people that you talk with?
Yeah, I do. And, you know, a lot of the people that I have been able to talk with about stuff like this, they're kind of like me. They don't trust psychologists or psychiatrists to help them through.
I think trust is a very big issue, you know, with a lot of victims and with a lot of other people too. Trust of information, not only just in a relationship, but even the people that are reaching out to try to help you. I think there has to be that issue of trust has to be resolved between two people.
That is true, and you're right. You know, trust is a very hard thing. I mean, even for me, 24 years later, I still have problems with trust issues.
Mm-hmm.
But they're not quite as bad as they used to be, because it seems like I can see things a whole lot clearer now than what I could then. But way back then, going through a lot of the stuff that I went through, I wish to God I had had somebody there that could have guided me through, rather than me feeling like I was treading water and I would keep going down, and I'd have to pull myself back up, and
I don't think there's
anything.
Any miracle people out there, but other than God. But I think there's a lot of people out there that you know, are very knowledgeable and have a good heart and want to help. And you know, a centralized location to even list these people and contact numbers and websites and everything, I think would be
absolutely
essential. Now, 24 years ago, what kind of person or organization, what was available? I mean, was there a shelters? Was there?
There was nothing. There wasn't any shelters. There weren't any organizations. Even with the police. There was a few times that I ended up calling the police out to my house, and they would see that I had a bloody nose, or they would see a bruise on my cheek, and they would end up saying, well, I'm sorry, this is a domestic dispute. There's nothing we can do.
A family affair.
Exactly. And when I questioned them by saying, you mean to tell me there isn't anything that you can do? And they'd say, well, the only time we can do anything is if he killed you.
Uh-huh.
And it was like, okay, well.
And so every time you pick up a paper now or see the news, I mean, every single day, it's like, if I can't have you, nobody will.
Exactly.
And we're not going to go through the court system. I'm not going to give up. We're not going to do this. So, okay, I'm just going to murder my whole family and be done with it.
That is so, it's so sick, and it's deranged. And,
it is.
It's horrible.
But I see that from what I'm seeing, this is where it's coming to. This is where, you know, rather than go through everything through the court system that you have been through and many, many, many others, the pain and suffering that you go through, to a lot of people I can see, heck, this isn't worth it.
That's true. And
you
then
get into a point of despair.
Very much so. And if they try to run, try to take their children and go somewhere where they feel that it's safe, then they got to look over their shoulder all the time.
Right, right.
And then they got to worry about whether, well, in my case, if it was me, even nowadays, I would be looking over my shoulder and I would be worrying about whether I'd be arrested for kidnapping my own kids and how to keep my kids safe and where could I hide my children and, you know,
You know, I have a question. And Denny, maybe if Abby doesn't know, maybe you know. What is the difference if someone, if the police are called for, you know, a fight, okay? You have, let's say, a husband and a wife, and they have a fight, and it's physical. Or you have a fight between two people that are out in a parking lot somewhere, and the police are called. Where's the line drawn to where you're charged with domestic violence or assault and battery? And are there different consequences for the two?
I think domestic would just basically pertain to family members, like husband, wife, sons, daughters, uncles, aunts, you know, so on and so forth. And assault and battery, I think that would probably be on like an outsider, a friend or something like that. But the one thing I do understand from all this, the person who usually gets arrested is the person who threw the first punch.
No. You know, the laws have changed a lot, or been laws added since I was working. But I think, in addition to what you said about the domestic piece, it would also include living in a domestic relationship without any formal paperwork. And I think now in most localities, every jurisdiction might have a slightly different law, but I believe they all require that arrest is mandatory if there's evidence. And somebody just said that probably the person who threw the first punch would be the one to be arrested. And that would be true. And they've taken, to a great degree in most locations, the choice away from the domestic partner. I remember years ago, you could go to a call, and there would be a situation that today would clearly have been an arrest, but the person who had suffered the injury or suffered what would have been an assault, by the time you got there, would join with his or her partner and go after you and decline to press any charges, decline to see their soulmate, if you will, carted off to the Huskow. So I think that's a big step forward, and that once the police arrive on the scene and they find the evidence necessary and can determine who did what, that it's an automatic arrest, and it's no longer just up to the aggrieved party to have to hang in there and follow through. And I think that's a good thing.
Well, Denny, are there different consequences, meaning like jail time, for assault and battery as opposed to domestic violence charges?
I don't know, and again, that would probably depend on the jurisdiction, because each jurisdiction would probably be different. I'm only aware for sure that most of them, I can't say everyone, but the ones I'm aware of, have this mandatory arrest involved, and I think that's a good thing. One of the calls that most police officers don't like to get involved in was usually domestic. And domestics are still awful dangerous. And even though you have to arrest someone, obviously the parties can turn on you before it's over with. That can still happen. But at least you don't put yourself in that position and, you know, trying to resolve the situation when somebody should be arrested, only to have your complainant or your victim back out on you and you've wasted your time and possibly gotten yourself in a dangerous situation. So I'm really glad to hear that there's been a change in that direction. But again, as far as whether there's more serious consequences for domestic violence, domestic assaults, as opposed to the stranger-type assaults, the guys fighting in an alley someplace, I can't really answer. I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm not sure either.
Mm. I just wondered. I figured, you know, go for the worst charges to keep them in jail the longest. To me, violence is violence. You know, if you're beating up on somebody, I don't. We all get so tied up in all the technicalities, and this is, I think, half the problem.
Which is true. And then when they tell you that you need to have like a restraining order issued against somebody, and people, they'll go ahead and they'll do it, but the other person violates the restraining order, it just seems like when they go into courts, it's almost a lost cause right off
right.
the bat. You know?
Well, it's just, I don't know if you had the opportunity to listen to Susan Murphy Milano's show this afternoon.
No.
She interviewed Amy Lechtenberg, who was the mother of Jack and Duncan Connolly, who's, her abuser violated 57 times. How can you violate 57 times and have no consequences? It just amazes me.
That is amazing. But I guess it all depends on the location where all this is going on, too.
Yeah. Well, there again, you know, just like you were describing earlier, you know, there was a lot of back and forth with court officials.
Oh, yeah.
A lot of it.
You ladies think that these orders of protection are a lot more bark than bite?
Oh, yeah. From what I've read and, you know, cases that I've looked at, it you know, it's a piece of paper. The piece of paper's not going to stop a bullet.
That's true.
Absolutely.
And it's not going to keep them away. So just like, you know, Cherry Simpson fighting for the GPS, I totally agree. I mean, it's not 100%. It's not, you know, the best thing since sliced bread, but it's a step in the right direction. It's one more rock they have to tumble over and get through to get back at you. And as many of those obstacles that we can put in their way, I think, is the way to go.
That's true. It seems like some of them like a challenge, too. And it's like you're giving mm-hmm. them a challenge with all these legal things. And they find some way to get over and,
mm-hmm.
you know, just be able to jump over it and say, okay, this is great, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to do what I'm going to do, and it doesn't matter what everybody else thinks or what this piece of paper says.
Right.
So you need to have things that are a whole lot firmer, and the GPS, I think, is a really good idea.
We had a guest on, or a caller, actually, a few shows ago who was a victim, and we were talking about the court system and how a lot of your victims of abuse are victimized twice. They're victimized by the abuser and then by the system. And this caller asked the question, how bad do you think the system is? And she said it needs to be gutted and start over.
Absolutely. I have to totally agree with that. And there's times I've wondered if there is a way that we could fire everybody in Washington and put in new people.
It's come down to the fact that each of us has to be responsible for our own protection in some way, whether it's protection in a relationship or protection out in the world. You know, it's like we have to be so cautious and so aware that it's not like it used to be. You know, little towns are just as mean as big cities these days.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, you can be physically assaulted anywhere. It's just, you know, like Annie Jacoby's female self-defense and personal safety classes are, it's almost a thing that should be mandatory in our schools. I mean, we need to teach our children something different. They need to see a different way of life somewhere rather
That's
than
true.
you know, growing up in that kind of an environment. But we do. We need to get out there and educate and teach not just little girls but little boys too.
I agree with that too. There's times I've thought that maybe it would be good in the school system, especially in the high school classes, about abuse and, you know, the domestic violence aspect and how to recognize everything with all the red flags and everything else. But it seems like in my kids at school, they're more interested in teaching them about the sex education than anything else. So I'd much rather all the kids, you know and understand, you know, all the red flags, the consequences, everything
or
else.
Or healthy relationships. Annie just put something in the chat room about healthy relationships. You know, what are we teaching in schools about healthy relationships? We teach them the ins and outs of sex education.
Yeah.
But where does a relationship come in into that education?
It doesn't even really seem to fit into that part right there. Yeah, they even have the kids, boys and girls, both carrying around a baby doll. And I think they're like on a timer or something, and they cry and all that. My kids haven't gotten to that aspect yet. But they're trying to teach them how to take care of infants. Well, you need to learn how to take care of a good relationship in order to be able to take good care of an infant or your child.
Exactly.
So, I don't know.
Exactly.
It's just crazy. It really is.
But, well, as we're winding down, I think my last question is, where do you see yourself now and where do you see yourself going? What does Abby want to do?
What does Abby want to do? Well, where I see myself at right now, I'm real happy with all the progress and the strength and courage and everything that I've managed to gather. And I would like to see what it is I can do to encourage survivors for a change somehow. I don't know how to do it, but we need to try to pave the way for, like, all the people who are going through all the heartache and heartbreak and everything in the court systems. We need to be able to pave the way for some sort of a really good change to where things aren't going this way. And I would advise anybody who's listening, Senator Nancy Schaefer has a YouTube clip, and she's basically wanting all, as many people as she can to get behind her, because she's trying to make changes and she's bringing awareness to everybody about how corrupt the court systems are and everything else. And
do you have that clip on your website?
Yeah, I've got it on my Survivors Holding Tight. And I have that clip there, and then I also have another one that I just put up. Senator Schaefer speaks at the World Congress, and it's a must-listen. And then there was one that she was on this one radio show. There's like four clips on there, I think, from this radio show, and she's talking with this radio host. I can't think of his name right off the bat, but I think, you know, a lot of people would find it very interesting. So if they want to log into my blog.
So we do have someone in our Senate that is trying to make a difference.
Yes.
And that's Senator Nancy Schaefer.
Senator Nancy Schaefer. And I'm not real sure if she's still a senator or not, but she's out of Georgia. But at one point, when I was listening to one of her clips, she had lost her job, and I think she ended up being a judge, but it was because she was speaking out and bringing awareness to what was going on with the court systems and the legal kidnapping. She even calls it legal kidnapping. So I think a lot of us, we need to get behind her, and I'm open to any kind of ideas that just little people like me.
all little people, but you know what?
True.
If we all stand together, we're a crowd.
That's true.
Ladies, I hate to interrupt, but we got about 2 seconds left. I want to thank Abby so much for you being our guest tonight, and Delilah,
you're
thank
welcome.
You. Thank you for being the co-host here. Great
thank
job.
Thank you.
Those who are in the chat room, thank you. And those who are listening, thank you very much. And we'll be back in 2 weeks. We're going to take a little break from domestic violence and have Lisa Sweetingham from formerly of Court TV, now True TV. And we're going to talk about three or four of the very interesting Black Widow murder cases. And then we'll be back on DV after that. Thank you very much, ladies, and have a great night.
You,
and thank you, listeners. Have a great evening also. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye, Danny. Night, Delilah.
Oh, thank you, Abby. Bye-bye.
Bye.